The Bible and Modern Science with your host, Dr. Joseph Henson of the Science Faculty of Bob Jones University. Here is Dr. Henson.
Thank you. On our last program, we had begun an introduction to the insect. For those of you that have been listening to the program for any length of time, it may have occurred to you that I seem to be partial toward insects, and I guess that's right because that's what the bulk of my graduate work was involved with. And over the years, it has simply developed to be my primary interest, I guess, in living things. I'm partial to animals rather than plants, and of the animals, I guess I'm much more interested in insects than any of the others. So we're getting ready to talk about a group of living things that are my favorites. On the last program, we talked a little bit about the importance of insects. For lots of folks, particularly women, I think they would prefer to avoid insects rather than pay attention to them. But on occasion, you don't have any choice about that. There are places, for example, in warm weather where you get outside in early evening and the mosquitoes are going to be there. Doesn't make any difference whether you pay attention to them or not. They're still going to be there. And there may be places where you have flies or bees or other things. And that simply is due course, depending on where you happen to be living. I made the comment that there are as many species of insects almost as there are everything else alive put together. Often my freshman classes, I will ask the question, comparing animals and plants, which of these two categories of living things are there more species of? And for reasons that I have never yet been able to figure out, the usual response I get, the opinion of these first year students, is that there are more plants than animals. And I really haven't figured out why that is. It's not close. Roughly all of the plants, including the bacteria and the fungi and all of those kinds of things, probably one-fourth the total of living things. So there are immensely greater numbers of living things, than that is species, than there are of plants. And there are probably a million or more species of arthropods. We've talked about that before. And species of insects, I would guess somewhere around 900,000 species, give or take. I don't know any way to get accurate figures for this because the figures change regularly. But at any rate, there are a lot of them. And we talked about that. We talked about their importance to humans. Probably the most beneficial function of insects is one that a lot of folks really don't pay much attention to, and that is simply the pollination of plants. Aside from grain, wheat, corn, oats, rye, for the most part, those grains are pollinated by the wind. But you get away from the grasses, and most of the food that we eat is the result of pollination by insects. I'm thinking about vegetables, fruit, that kind of thing. And we enjoy them. I hope you eat plenty of fresh fruit and vegetables, but we don't generally think about the pollination. This leads me to a comment that I ran across not long ago, dealing with the idea of the relationship between plants and insects, the pollination that they do. If the evolutionary argument obviously ought to be that if plants can be pollinated only by insects, and there are some that are exclusively pollinated by insects, there are a few instances where it has to be a specific insect that does the pollination. I think about the yucca plant, for example. There is only one species of insect that can pollinate that plant. So where this relationship is necessary, then it obviously is necessary for both organisms to be present at the same time. And if you're going to try and get both of them present by a process of evolution, then there are some difficulties here. But looking on the more general picture of insect pollination of fruits and vegetables, it is a point at least worth noting. Now, I want to read a couple of paragraphs here of from a book by Stephen Gould. And if you know much of anything about biology and evolutionary biology in particular, then you're aware that Stephen Gould was one of the foremost spokesmen defending that. I'm reading from a book that's called, was entitled In the Mind of the Beholder. It wasn't a book. It was an article that appeared in Natural History back in 1994. Quote, looking at the taxonomic level of insect families, Labandera and Ciprosky could find no evidence for any positive impact of the angiosperm radiation upon insect diversity. Now, for most of you, I think that comment probably needs to be untangled. Angiosperms are simply seed plants. Those things that most of us think about when we think about plants, flowers, fruits, etc. Now, they are dependent on pollination by insects. And the question comes then, how was it possible, if I think most evolutionists would argue likely that the plants came first, well, how could the plants be pollinated if there were no insects? And if the insects were evolving at the same time, what effect would there be on insect evolution by virtue of the fact that the plants were there? This is the thing that Gould is addressing himself to. And then he follows that up with this statement, quote, how can this be? Doesn't Darwinism proclaim that organisms change within webs of competition and interaction toward mutually beneficial states? And he's simply making an observation about this problem. It should be apparent with a little thought that this relationship had to exist. The groups, the insects and the plants, had to exist together. And the idea of one of them appearing before the other and then somehow getting along for millions of years before the other appeared, or if they were both together, why in the world would insects evolve with the proclivity of pollinating plants? And it's just one of these things. There's really no good evolutionary answer for it. And the response, oh, well, that's what's happening today. And I grant that. That is what's happening today. But that's not the question. The question is, how could that relationship, the essential relationship for the life, in some cases, of both insect and plant, is dependent on the relationship. And it had to work right the first time. From the origin of each of those groups of organisms, this relationship had to exist. That's just an interesting notion. There really is not a good answer for an evolutionist. For a creationist, obviously, we would interpret this simply to mean that this is evidence of the order and pattern that God created, brought into existence when he created things in the first place. Now, this is not an acceptable answer, I recognize, for most evolutionists, but I still would be interested to hear a reasonable comment by evolutionists about this. And it's interesting to me that Gould himself noted the difficulty. I ran across two or three other comments involving insects, and I thought while we were introducing the subject, it might be worth noting them. Again, Stephen Gould, in a book entitled The Wonderful Life, let me begin back at the beginning of this. Quote, an old paleontological joke proclaims that mammalian evolution is a tale told by teeth mating to produce slightly altered descendant teeth. And again, it might be well to comment about what he's saying for those of you that don't know much about biology. Teeth are often the only remnant of organisms. by virtue of the fact that they are harder, they will last longer under natural conditions after death. So teeth are found when not much else is found. So you have organisms with certain kind of teeth. All of a sudden you dig in a different place and you find completely different teeth that apparently belong to the same kind of organism. And he is simply making a reference to the notion that teeth give rise to teeth. And obviously they do not. Teeth are in animals that will mate and produce other animals. In any case, since enamel is far more durable than ordinary bone, teeth may prevail when all else has succumbed to the whips and scorns of geological time. The majority of fossil mammals are known only by their teeth. Now that is an interesting comment that those of you that may continue listening might bear in mind. We'll talk about that probably when we get to the fossils. In many cases, in mammals, the only remains that ever are found are teeth. And even when bones are found, they're usually fragmentary. Few exceptions, few happy exceptions to that. But usually that's the case. Now, Gould goes on with his comment. Darwin wrote that our imperfect fossil record is like a book preserving just a few pages. Of these pages, few lines. Of the lines, few words. And of those words, few letters. Darwin used this metaphor to describe the chances of preservation for ordinary hard parts, even for maximally durable teeth. What hope can then be offered to flesh and blood amidst the slings and arrows of such outrageous fortune? Soft parts can only be preserved by a stroke of good luck in an unusual geological context, insects and amber, sloth dung in desiccated caves. Otherwise, they quickly succumb to the thousand natural shocks that flesh is heir to, death, disaggregation, and decay, to name but three. And his comment is dealing with the idea of some of the problems dealing with the preservation of fossils. As I read this, what leaped to my mind, probably 3 weeks ago, four maybe, I don't recall exactly, I pulled an article off internet complete with pictures of petrified jellyfish. Now, the evolutionists often argue that soft fossils are not preserved, and yet jellyfish are probably about as soft as you can get. And in Canada, there are places where there are hundreds, if not thousands, of these things formed. So the point of the comment and the point of my bringing up here is simply to point out that when we start talking about how things are preserved, there are some immense difficulties for the evolutionist. As far as insects are concerned, there are immense problems for the evolutionist.
Thank you, Dr. Henson. You may send email to Dr. Henson at jhenson@bju.edu. That's jhenson@bju.edu. Or write to Dr. Joseph L. Henson, Box 34621, Bob Jones University, Greenville, South Carolina, zip code 29614, in the United States of America. You're invited to listen next time for The Bible and Modern Science.